Life.
Dignity.
Security.
Freedom.
Freedom.
Respect.
Justice.
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 Just this.
Just this.
Equality.
Equality.
Remedy.
And protection.
Fairness.
Fair time.
Privacy.
Right.
Well.
Peace.
Movement.
This is my mistake, and let me make it good. I raised the wall, and I will be the one to knock it down.
Asylum.
Identity.
Family.
Home.
Conscience.
Expression.
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 Participation.
Democracy.
Welfare.
Work.
Work.
Leisure.
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 Health.
Education.
Progress.
Culture.
Human rights.
Cartagena.
Solidarity.
Responsibility.
Fill in the mortar. I raise the wall, and I'm the only one. I will be the one to knock it down.
Good day to our listeners on CJTR Community Radio at 91.3 FM, and welcome to everyone tuning in over the internet at cjtr.ca. Wherever you are, welcome to Human Rights Radio, hosted weekly by Amnesty International volunteers, who are a worldwide movement of people dedicated to the promotion of human rights and the safety of all human beings. We're building a world in which every person enjoys the rights included in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and other human rights standards. Our theme song is titled 30 Words, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, written and performed by REM and a global collection of musicians. I'm Jim Hutchings, and joined today by my co-host Gordon Barnes. Good morning, Gord.
Good morning, Jim.
I guess it's actually afternoon, eh?
We
just,
that's right.
Just got past the noon hour there.
Yeah.
And Gordon and I are going to talk about a variety of things this morning, this afternoon, this noon hour. And we'll start off by mentioning International Women's Day 2013. And International Women's Day is actually celebrated on March 8th.
Yeah, just 2 weeks from now.
2 weeks from now. And next week's program, Human Rights Radio, we're going to have some guests on. We're going to be talking about International Women's Day. I've got a poster in front of me here, International Women's Day, Women Leading the Way for Change, Ending HIV/AIDS Transmission. And that is going to happen. That's a presentation that's going to happen. It's going to be free, and it's at the Language Institute Theater, LI215, at the University of Regina. And there's free parking in Lot 3 of Area M. And I'm sure you'll find that poster, and if you need to find that information again, I'm sure you'll be able to track it down on the internet.
Definitely. It's actually on the AmnestySaskatchewan.ca website as an upcoming event, and our members of our local Amnesty International group in Regina have been working with another number of community organizations and partners at the university to put together the event for the afternoon of March 8th, and I think it'll be really interesting. If people have an opportunity to participate, I think they'll find it very worthwhile.
Yep, and of course it is international, and there's going to be thousands of events occurring, not just on this day, but throughout March, to mark the economic, political, and social achievements of women. And women's organizations around the world choose different themes each year relevant to global and local gender issues. Amnesty International and several other groups have identified the period around March 8, 2013 as a key moment for our work on the 20th year review of the implementation of the International Conference on Population and Development Program of Action, ICPD 20. Despite commitments made nearly 20 years ago, many of the 1.8 billion young people worldwide still struggle to access information, sexuality education, and sexual and reproductive health services they need. The sexual and reproductive rights of many more are at risk in future if world leaders fail to keep their promises. The next 2 years are crucial for protecting and advancing sexual and reproductive rights. Throughout 2013, world leaders will meet to provide, or rather to discuss progress on sexual and reproductive rights. During this process, we'll need to combat an increasingly well-funded and organized attack on sexual and reproductive rights and gender equality from various entities such as faith-based groups and conservative governments. This will be essential to ensure previous commitments are not watered down and that women's and girls' rights are not undermined. Again this year, we encourage Amnesty activists to find out what International Women's Day events are planned in their communities, to join those activities and create visibility for our messages. And we're going to be building momentum towards reaching our ICPD plus 20 objectives. So on March 8th, we're going to be celebrating the achievements of women while remaining vigilant and tenacious in demanding full respect for women and girls' rights. Okay, so that's just a little preview of what's happening in the next couple of weeks.
Right. And, you know, something else that's going to be coming up in March, and I thought we'd maybe spend some time talking about this in the first half hour of the program, Jim, is in March 2013, there will be further discussions at the United Nations for a final, an attempt to at least achieve in a final way an arms trade treaty. And this is really quite significant.
That's what we were busy passing out those bananas there a little while ago, wasn't it, Garth?
That's right. The significance of the bananas in arms trade is that it's actually easier to ship weapons internationally, things like AK-47s, in terms of getting permits and all the rest, than it is to move bananas around the world. And, you know, it's kind of ironic. It's a sad statement, really, about how things are regulated. And a large number of organizations in civil society, including Amnesty International, are campaigning for an effective arms trade treaty. There were talks at the United Nations ongoing over the last number of years. We had hoped, actually, that there wouldn't be agreement last July in July 2012. However, unfortunately, key players to the discussions, including China and the United States, did not support that moving forward. So it's back on the table in March of 2013, and we're encouraging people to really follow the discussions. We're hoping that all governments will finally come to their senses in terms of recognizing there does need to be strong rules that protect human rights, preventing arms from being sent when there is a danger that the recipients will use them to seriously violate human rights, and also that we need a control list relative to the kinds of weapons and munitions and other arms that are being exported internationally, and very clear rules to apply and monitor relative to an arms trade treaty, so that there can be regular public reporting to ensure that treaty rules are enforced. Now, this is really going to take a lot of pressure from the international community on governments around the world. Arms manufacturers are very active in their own lobbying. Quite significantly, just yesterday, a large international defense exhibition and conference concluded in Dubai. And, you know, it's incredible, the scale of these things. It was a week-long exhibition where there were exhibitors from large numbers of countries, actually over 1,100 companies from over 60 countries at this year's conference and exhibition. And they were trying to sell weapons of unbelievable range to a variety of buyers. And, you know, these are things that are being used regularly where there are significant human rights concerns. Just to give you a couple examples to share with our listeners today, there were state-owned manufacturers from China exhibiting at this conference, and they had heavy weaponry and also Pakistan. And in each case, those companies were selling arms to Sri Lanka, which has emerged, and they've been selling arms to Sri Lanka over a number of years now. But they've just emerged from a bitter three-decade armed conflict that concluded in 2009. And during that period, Amnesty International identified China actually as one of the biggest arms suppliers to the Sri Lankan armed forces. And both the Sri Lankan government and the armed separatist group, the Tamil Tigers organization, committed serious human rights violations during that period, and tens of thousands of civilians were killed and many more injured and abused. And really, that's as a consequence of them being able to, the parties to the conflict there being able to acquire weapons. Also, Amnesty International has been able to document that Chinese cartridges were among those found in the DRC and Democratic Republic of Congo, where government soldiers committed rape, torture, and other sexual violence. Also on display this week at the conference and exhibition that I was referring to were many other kinds of weapons, including chemical irritants like tear gas and crowd control equipment and things like water cannons. They've been used widely where there are significant concerns about human rights abuses. And that's why we're working so hard to raise awareness of this discussion that's going to be taking place. You know, even something that is so inherently inhumane as cluster munitions were exhibited there. One exhibitor from South Korea was on hand and selling these kinds of weapons. Cluster bombs have been reused in a number of recent conflicts, and Russian and actually Spanish-made cluster munitions were photographed in 2011 in Libya. If you can imagine, during that conflict, they were able to acquire, the parties to the conflict were able to acquire cluster bombs.
So when you say these are things that would be dropped from aircraft or what?
Yeah, and you know, used in with rockets in a variety of ways. And actually, now the conflict in Syria, the parties to the conflict there, and particularly the government, have been able to acquire cluster bombs. And you know, the consequence of this is that they've seen, in many cases, just incredible atrocities as a result. Legs blown off, children who, you know, have been victims of terrible, terrible atrocities. And you know, the indiscriminate use of these kinds of weapons, even after the conflict ends, because in many cases they're, you know, they're not detonated. They're used in the conflict, but they're not necessarily detonated. And later, children come across them. Another concern with respect to the arms trade treaty is that really, the Global Arms Trade Treaty contributes to the use of child soldiers. And again, that's a consequence that Amnesty International and other organizations have been able to document. For example, in Mali and close to 20 other countries, poorly regulated arms trade has continued to contribute to the conflict, or recruitment, I should say, and use of boys and girls under the age of 18 in conflict by armed groups and, in some cases, by government forces. So, you know, the need for people in terms of people who are active in civil society organizations like Amnesty International and others to come together and really work on this is very high priority. In Mali, in recent weeks, where it's obviously been in the news, Amnesty International delegates have interviewed eyewitnesses as well as children who were actually recruited by armed groups currently fighting. You know, that's just one specific example where there's a current conflict. Kids are involved, carrying rifles. One of them, in one case, one of the Amnesty International delegates was able to report that one of the kids was so small that his rifle was sometimes dragging on the ground. So, but they had been recruited.
Unbelievable.
By a consequence of, you know, that armed conflict and easy access to weapons by various parties to the conflict.
Yeah, that is amazing. That is amazing. We definitely have a long way to go there, for sure.
And, you know, the other thing, Jim, that I wanted to refer to in this first half hour, and it, there's a relationship to the arms trade and obviously the conflict in Syria. Easy access to weapons has really meant the prolonging of the conflict there. And we've mentioned on the program previously now that significant numbers of people have been killed. The United Nations figures are that there are over 60,000 people now who have been killed as a result of the conflict in Syria. And yet the international community is failing to bring a conclusion to that conflict or any resolution. And as a result, again, of the easy access to weapons, the conflict continues, and now there are over 620,000 refugees that have fled the conflict in Syria to neighboring countries, putting significant strain on the resources of those countries, including Turkey and Jordan, neighboring countries. Jordan has actually accepted over 185,000 refugees itself, a neighboring country, but has said, you know, that if the government in Syria collapses, which is a high potential right now, there's going to be Jordan is anticipating there's going to be even more pressure with respect to refugees. And this time of year, with the weather there, it's very difficult for the people who are trying to provide and support refugees in that region. The weather conditions are very difficult, and people don't have a proper shelter. Jordan has actually said it will not continue to accept further refugees, and we're really concerned in terms of Amnesty International that's the case, and wanting to flag that as a concern over the next few weeks, because the way things are developing in Syria, it does look like you know, there could be an end to the conflict. It does look like there's a possibility the government will fall. And although, you know, that nobody really knows the time frame for any of this, and as I say, thanks to the international arms trade and easy access to weapons, so many people have been killed as a result of the conflict in that specific country.
Yeah, and an awful lot of these are civilians. That's the tragic part of it. They're not combatants. They're just caught in the crossfire.
That's definitely, and you know, clearly the people who are fleeing as refugees are people who want to escape the violence there. You know, we are very concerned about what has been going on in Syria over the last year, but in particular in the last few months, you know, there have been reports about people who are human rights lawyers who have disappeared, and doctors who are trying to provide assistance to people who are, you know, as you mentioned, Jim, civilians who have disappeared and in other cases have been detained. If you can imagine, human rights lawyers, there's specific examples that are on current appeals on the Amnesty International website. Human rights lawyers and also doctors who have been either detained or disappeared, and there's real concerns about their safety, and even if they're alive anymore. We're encouraging people to, you know, visit the Amnesty website, where there's readily access to appeal information and urgent actions that we're working on currently. So those are some updates with respect to the specific situation in Syria that I wanted to share this morning, because I know there's a lot of people who even in our community here in Regina and elsewhere, who really share a concern about what's going on there. And have been, even in conversations I've had with people, have been asking for us to provide updates and make more people aware of the very significant problems that exist for people just getting by in terms of daily life there.
And, of course, that's one of the things that Amnesty does, is they go in at some risk to themselves, I have to say, to basically witness what's going on and do some investigating and just try to get the facts so that we know what direction we should be heading in.
That's right. Yeah, a lot of work in terms of the research undertaken by people, and also, you know, obviously in the particular example of the Syrian conflict, a lot of work goes on in terms of interviewing people who are refugees. To discover more about what's going on in the conflict there.
Mm-hmm.
There is one thing that, just to shift away from that whole topic just before the break, if we can take a couple of minutes to update people on that, I think it's worth making people aware that happened just this week as well, this last week, and it's in a different country completely, but in Zimbabwe, which we've talked about here on the show before, because many of us have an awareness of the work of WOZA, the Women of Zimbabwe Arise, there was a large attacks by police on Zimbabwean human rights defenders quite recently. A number of people who were protesting were in a peaceful way were arrested and beaten. Eight members of WOZA, the Women of Zimbabwe, were arrested outside the parliament, and they were handing out roses and teddy bears during their annual Valentine's Day demonstration. So, you know, they weren't really doing anything that would be described as very confrontational in terms of, you know, roses and teddy bears typically aren't thought of as being something that are going to get people into difficulty. However, as a consequence, people were arrested and detained and beaten. One of them was, I'm sorry to hear the news with respect to this in particular, was Jenny Williams, who heard, I think, Jim, you were there in Montreal a few years ago.
Yep.
Jenny Williams is one of the leaders of WOZA, and she was able to come to Canada and talk about her work And all of us who had an opportunity were so impressed, Jim,
absolutely,
to hear her speak.
One of the things I remember, just as an aside here, her saying that you know, whenever she was going to do any protesting, she made sure that her hair was cut short so that they wouldn't have something to grab onto.
Yeah.
Very, you know, it's very sad to think of it. And she was quite serious.
Yeah.
And her hair was quite short.
And the remarkable thing about Jenny Williams and the people involved with WOSA that I think all of us will reflect on is that she was emphatic about her insistence that in terms of the human rights work and protests that they're involved with, that everything they undertake be done in a peaceful way in Zimbabwe. And yet, unfortunately, they're met with very, very significant levels of repression, and that's very disappointing.
Yeah, for sure.
So I think, are we getting close to break time, Jim? How are we doing for time here this morning?
A little over 2 minutes.
Okay. I just, if we could, you know, there's one other thing that is worth reflecting on, and that is that it, actually we're now marking the year after anniversary of the Pussy Riot protest song in Moscow, and the deterioration as a consequence of freedom of expression in that country. Two members of Pussy Riot are continuing to be detained, and we're really wanting to recall that. We're continuing to send appeals on behalf of both women who have young children, by the way, and wanting to raise more awareness of their circumstance. And again, people can visit our website and get more information.
I just remembered something, Gord.
What's that?
We have to talk about our Look and Listen Lottery.
Okay.
Look and Listen Lottery is happening now, and you can get tickets. And so we have to start spreading the news. The grand prize, again, is a trip for two to New York City. And so you get return airfare for two, a four-star hotel for 3 nights. You get Broadway show tickets and Mets or Yankees baseball tickets, tickets for Kramer's Seinfeld reality tour, plus $1,000 cash to spend any way you want. So that's pretty impressive.
So tickets are on sale now?
They are.
And
they
where do they get them?
They can get them from us.
All right. Here at the station, I guess?
They can come to the station, and CJTR programmers and supporters have them for sale. You probably know some CJTR programmers and supporters, and if you don't, come on down to the station and meet some.
Okay. Well, maybe we can come back to that in the very last portion of the program and remind people about the details of that. And
alrighty. Let's see now. I'm just looking along here. How much is a... tickets are $20, and there's only 1,200 available.
Really? And so, you get a chance to win a trip to New York?
Trip to New York, and second prize is a travel voucher from Carlson Vaughan Lee Rickert Travel. Third prize is a weekend getaway at Moose Jaw's Temple Gardens Mineral Spa, courtesy Casinos Regina and Moose Jaw. Two-night stay and $100 spending money.
Well, I'm in for a ticket or two.
Alrighty. Well, we'll take a break here right now, and then I think we're... if we're going to talk about First Nations children and the services, the disparity in services that, that they experience. So we'll be back here in about 2 minutes or so.
Thank you.
And that young man is a fellow by the name of George Leach. And Gordon and I had the pleasure of hearing George last Sunday and the Sunday before that at a special presentation at the Artful Dodger. George is from B.C. He's from the Titkat community. That's near Lillooet, I'm thinking, in B.C. And you just got a very small sample of how he performs on the guitar and great vocals. And that's from the CD called Just Where I'm At, George Leach. And he wrote and produced all the songs, all the guitar tracks, all the vocal tracks, bass tracks. It's all a George Leach, and it's just a fantastic example of what he's all about. And I would certainly recommend this particular CD. And if you have a chance to go and see George Leach, I would definitely recommend it. So what was he doing here, Gordon?
Well, he was part of an event that was at the Artful Dodger, as you mentioned, that Errol Canistano put together, and I really want to recognize the work that was involved by Errol and a number of people who contributed to the evening. And what it did was bring together a number of First Nations musicians who put on a fabulous concert. It was to support the Treaty 4 Idle No More grassroots movement, and also Amnesty International was very pleased to be invited to participate and to have a display there. We were there for a particular reason. It's worth mentioning that during that time frame, we were encouraging people, and you can still do this if you would like, to participate in what's called the Have a Heart campaign. And that's an initiative that Amnesty International is in Canada is undertaking to support the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society, which is working to address the concern with respect to underfunding of services for First Nations children across Canada who are living on reserve. It's really creating a crisis situation for these children and their families. Actually, today, if you can imagine today, there's a greater percentage of First Nations children who are being taken away from their families than it was the case at the height of the residential school era, which is really quite significant to reflect on. At the heart of the problem really is the fact that the federal government budget for children's services in First Nations communities is at least 22% per child less than what the provincial governments dedicate for child welfare services in other communities. And that is despite the fact that often there's greater needs and higher costs in terms of delivering services in many small and remote First Nations communities.
Yeah, if you consider where these communities are.
That's right.
And how difficult it is to provide services.
Yeah, and you compound that with an awareness that there isn't the same level of services in terms of education or safe housing or clean water. Services that really are fundamental to human rights, then you know that you can see where there is a crisis in terms of what's happening in many First Nations communities across Canada and support for children. Unfortunately, the federal government has actually opposed a complaint that's the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society filed.
Cindy Blackstock was involved with that.
That's right. It's a complaint that was filed with the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal, and Amnesty International has supported that complaint. It's been an ongoing case for 5 years now. The federal government tried opposing the case on technical grounds, has actually not been successful recently. There were court decisions that mean this will move forward at that level at the Canadian Human Rights Tribunal. But, you know, this is something where really, it shouldn't be something that has to be fought out in any venue like that. People can readily find at the amnesty.ca site more information about this case, and also a link to the website for the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society. And at that point, you'd be able to find more information how even now you could participate quite simply in the Have a Heart campaign by selling, sending, I should say, on a belated basis, a Valentine to the Prime Minister or maybe your Member of Parliament saying you support proper and equitable levels of funding for child welfare services on reserve. So that's what the event was all about that George performed at, that, again, I want to pay significant recognition to Errol Knistel, who brought all the musicians, entertainers together. And I think, Jim, you've got a little bit of a, or a, maybe a longer bit of a video or YouTube piece to share with our listeners, because it really is a good presentation and background about this issue.
Yeah, and it is on YouTube, so if you want to go and see it yourself, it's there. I'm going to just read some of the captions. It's called Letters to Canada, and it starts off, Dear Canada, this is the caption, and then I'll bring up the audio when we get past the captions. Dear Canada, messages of reconciliation from children and young people, and we'll move along here. I think it's going. Oh, no. Here we go. All right. Children and young people share why a historic human rights case on First Nations children, that's what Gord was just talking about here, youth and families, matters to them and the Canada they want to grow up in. Okay. In 2007, the First Nations Child and Family Caring Society and the Assembly of First Nations filed a human rights complaint against the federal government alleging that Canada is discriminating against First Nations children by failing to provide equitable and culturally based child and family services on reserve. The federal government has spent over $3 million and 5 years in its unsuccessful efforts to get the case dismissed on jurisdictional grounds. The Canadian Human Rights Tribunal will begin hearing evidence on the case on February 25, 2013. That's this Monday. And we're moving along here.
I believe Canada is a country where justice and fairness are important values.
I think it's really unfair that the conditions that First Nations people have to live through every day.
First Nations children are Canadian children and must be treated fairly and equally.
That every child is just as valuable as anyone else, and that no one deserves to be just forgotten in a system that is very old and doesn't really work so well.
Other Canadians need to know that that people that are living in Canada don't have the same services that they do.
First Nations people, like in the history of Canada, have faced like a lot of different inequalities in different ways, like throughout history and like now still. Just like people talk about like the residential schools, like those are really sad and terrible, and it's good that we apologize, but an apology doesn't fix it.
Usually most people think Canada is a place where everybody's treated fairly, but then sometimes we forget about our First Nations children.
Aboriginals are growing up and living in situations and places where they don't have the same rights, and this is a black mark on Canada's reputation.
There's not all equal funding for all people in Canada, because they're living in like third world conditions. Like people are in like countries in Africa or something.
I want Canada to know that children can change more than just our country, but they can also change the world, and that children can see when there's something wrong and they want to fix it.
Everybody would have access to water and health care and education.
And they should have the right to go to a good school, to have houses, clean water, food, and to have actually a real job when they grow up, and to have a dream, and to make it come true when they're older.
I'm sure that they need to have everything what we have, like a warm house, lots of stuff to keep them happy, proud, and healthy.
Un abri, une famille, de l'amour, et puis l'éducation, la santé.
I feel that First Nations children should grow up in their community.
As I was growing up, I had an elder who taught me a lot of stuff. Like, my mom was really into that, like, because she never had it when she was growing up, because her parents were, like, they're all sent to residential schools. My dad's parents, too, they're never allowed to come out as who they are.
One of my elders said that it takes a community to raise a child. So everyone's kind of connected, and everyone, like, kind of looks out for each other. So, like, we kind of, like, are like a big family sort of thing. Like, we're all, like, extended, and we're all looking out for the betterment of each other.
When they're first growing up, like, they need a good family, a good home. Like, they have to know themselves. Like, who they are as people, especially Aboriginal children. They have to know who they are.
It takes a community to raise a child, not just two people. So if you're taking First Nations children out of their communities, they're cut off from all that, and they don't have those supports and those people that are so important to them and who are going to teach them. Like, everybody's going to teach that child about who they are and where they're from.
The best place where First Nations children to grow up would be in their families and in the community mostly, because they need a strong foundation and they need to know, like, who they are.
Discrimination is when, because of a certain characteristic like boy or girl, age, or race, is where someone says, oh, you're not good enough for this, or no, you can't have this because you're blah, 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 right? And it makes me feel upset because I think people should be treated equally.
Ben, moi, je trouve que la discrimination, c'est de l'injustice. Je crois qu'il ne devrait même pas avoir un mot pour ça. On ne peut pas avoir de l'injustice dans notre propre pays.
Discrimination, to me, is when someone gets something that's a right and someone else doesn't get something that is a right. So I find that Canada has a lot of rights, and that is very nice, but I wish they would keep up to their rights.
I think discrimination is giving somebody something less than another person based on, you know, gender, age, or, you know, skin color.
Discrimination towards First Nations children, like from the residential schools to, like, even our child welfare. Like, they're not there, it doesn't seem like they're there to help, but just to, I don't know, take the children away.
I feel there is a lot of discrimination against Indigenous peoples in Canada because our programs and our services don't get as much funding dollars as non-Native organizations.
You just take a look at the statistics that, and even inside of our jails, you know, the overrepresentation of the children that are inside of the child welfare system is just a sign of the discrimination.
Discrimination is kind of deciding that some people are better than others, or some people aren't worth the money. So, like, not providing First Nations with the same health care benefits or school or whatever, that's discrimination, because you're basically telling them that they aren't as important as other children in Canada.
This is not a new issue. It is a reoccurring issue that keeps happening to First Nations people across Canada.
And I think it's pretty upsetting.
The reality is, in Canada, we are currently facing a crisis. The gap between Canadians and Indigenous peoples with regards to child welfare continues to increase. For Canada, It's not about the real lack of funds. They do have the money. It's about the lack of will and essentially leaving our people in cycles of poverty.
The Mi'kmaq family only gets like a portion of the funds that non-Native child welfare organizations get. So they're doing a lot of the services with only a fraction of the funding. So they have a lot of problems with being able to deliver services. Our organizations need to be able to have the same level of funding as other, as non-Native organizations. We need to be more in control of our child welfare organizations. There needs to be more supports for families. We need to have prevention measures in place.
It's systematic, you know, they get thrown into this system and then they start living these lives that are unhealthy, or they're not, they don't know who they are, they can't find their identity.
Most of the reasons why children go into care are because of poverty, poor housing, and addictions. So poverty and poor housing, we can fix those with funding. They're very easy problems to fix, so we need money to work on those issues in our communities. It takes a community to raise a child, not just two people. So if you're taking First Nations children out of their communities, they're cut off from all that, and they don't have those supports and those people that are so important to them and who are going to teach them. Like, everybody's going to teach that child about who they are and where they're from.
The best place for First Nations children to grow up is in their community, but they shouldn't have to go somewhere to grow up. They should be able to stay in their community, and in their community they should have a school and proper health care.
And if you don't have that, it's going to be really hard for these children. They're going to feel really disconnected. They're going to have a lot of problems when they get older, with self-esteem, with confidence, because they're not going to know who they are and where they're from. Children need to be safe, and they need to be in their communities, and they need to be around all their family.
If I didn't know who I was living here, I'd feel like lost, like confused, and like I'd feel like I don't have something I should have.
They're just the same as any other person in Canada, and they deserve the same amount of support.
First Nations children aren't getting the same access to health care and education, and they have to sometimes travel far away to get the same the human rights that all of us enjoy.
Moi je trouve que les enfants c'est le futur.
I want Canada to know that children can change more than just our country, but they can also change the world. And that children can see when there's something wrong and they want to fix it.
20 years from now, I'd like to see all First Nations having a better life and not that stereotype to be completely erased from people's memories, and that First Nations people are one of the strongest and like most proud parts of Canadian culture.
S'ils prennent une bonne décision, les enfants ils seraient prêts pour l'avenir, puis les enfants sont juste la magie pour la terre, parce que comme j'ai dit, sans les enfants notre terre est pas colorée, puis c'est juste, les enfants, c'est une partie du monde tellement importante pour avoir.
Oh, I'd like to see everyone, like, on the same level, no one higher than other, no youth higher than other category of youth, everyone, like, just, yeah, everyone just the same, like.
My dream for First Nations children is to have the equality between non-First Nations and First Nations when it comes to funding and helping them.
If we all had clean water, good healthcare system, good education, like, that's what I'd like to see.
I wish that Canada would give all children the equal rights to an education, and they would provide everyone with healthcare in their community so they don't have to travel far away. And I wish that I could proudly say that Canada is a completely equal country and it doesn't discriminate against anyone.
Little pieces of the
The First Nations Child and Family Caring Society gratefully acknowledges the children and young people who participated in this film. And that's about it for that. The captions kind of zipped by on me. I'd invite you to go to YouTube and have a look at this video yourself and just look for Letters to Canada. And before we go, Gord, I think we have to talk about the Look and Listen Lottery.
Well, here's the tip. Right at the beginning of this little promotion here, get your pen out and write down this number. It's 525-7274. That's the number you can call here at the station to get your Look and Listen Lottery tickets for the CJTR 2013 raffle. Now, the prizes are absolutely amazing. You mentioned them before, Jim, but it's worth repeating. Tickets are just $20, and only 1,200 tickets will be available. The grand prize is a trip for two to New York City, return airfare for two, a four-star hotel for three nights, Broadway show tickets, and Mets or Yankees baseball tickets, tickets for Kramer's Seinfeld reality tour, plus a $1,000 cash to spend in any way you want. That is the grand prize, and it's only $20 for a ticket, and you get, you know, one of 1,200 chances to win. Second prize is a $1,000 travel voucher from Carlson Vagen Lee Rickert Travel. And third prize is a weekend getaway at Moose Jaw's Temple Gardens Mineral Spa, courtesy of Casino Regina Moose Jaw. Plus, now that in that case, it's a two-night stay and $100 of spending money. Now, as mentioned earlier, you can call in at 525-7274 during regular hours here at the station, and you can order by credit card. Also, you can go to the CJTR.ca website and find more information about the raffle. Now, this is an important fundraiser for community radio. CJTR, as you know, is a volunteer-driven community radio station. There are more than 100 volunteers who deliver a wide diversity of music, spoken word, and multicultural programs. So,
okay. Great. Thanks, Gord. And we are totally out of time here. So I'll just mention that Peter Benenson, the founder of Amnesty International, often said it's better to light a candle of hope than to curse the darkness.